Welcome back to this edition of Berlin Journal on NPR Berlin and NPR Worldwide. I'm RJ McGill.
And I'm Ashley Bamford.
Then I surprised myself by writing a book about two characters that people liked.
University of Mississippi writer and professor Tom Franklin.
In my early books, the characters were, in some cases, barely human. They were more animal, and they were harder for humans to identify with. But suddenly, with Crooked Letter, I'd written Larry Ott and Silas Jones, and people could root for them. So it took me four books to learn this. And Crooked Letter sold very well, you know, for me, not for Stephen King or Michael Chabon or Dennis Lehane, but for me it sold really well. And I noticed that. And I thought, well, I like this. I like that I can, you know, that my clothes are a little bit better now. My glasses are a little bit better now. We added on to our house. It's fun to sell books.
Writer Tom Franklin is working on a new book, a horror story. This is not out of the ordinary for the best-selling author. Franklin's body of work is a curious blend of mystery, thriller, horror, and the high literary genres, otherwise known as gritty Southern Gothic. For our program today, he sat down with Berlin-based poet and translator Alexander Booth to walk us through what he's working on now and to talk about growing up and writing about the American South.
Tom Franklin, the title of your talk at the American Academy Berlin was accidentally autobiographical.
Well, that talk was about my novel Crooked Letter, Crooked Letter, which I should probably say is the way that children in the South are taught to spell Mississippi. And we're taught to spell it M-I, crooked letter I, crooked letter I, humpback, humpback I. So I wrote much of this book in Brazil, which was kind of a surprise to me. I'd been under contract for this book with William Morrow for about 8 or 9 years, and was having a hard time writing it. In fact, I stopped writing it and wrote another book called Smunk, which is spelled S-M-O-N-K, in the meantime, and then went back to the book that became Crooked Letter. My wife loves to travel. She's the reason we're in Berlin. She's the one who urged me to apply to the American Academy. And she got a Fulbright to Brazil, and I was not excited about it. I did not want to go to what I thought was a third world country where I would be mugged, where I wouldn't know the language. And we wound up having an amazing time. And we were in a city called Belo Horizonte, which means beautiful horizon. And it has the most bars per capita of any place on earth, we were told, which should have been dangerous for me, except I couldn't speak the language to get a cab to go to a bar. So I was relegated to our condo. And because I was out of my comfort zone and away from everything that I knew, I had to rely solely on memory. And typically when I write a book, they're often set in the outdoors. I love the rural areas. I grew up in Alabama in a very, very small place. And so I walk those lands and I look at the way the bark is, how an acorn looks, the way the leaves are, the dew on a spider web, and I put those things into the books. Well, in Brazil, the landscape was so different that I couldn't use any of those details. And details are what make fiction work. So I had to just remember it. And the more I remembered, the more I began to use my own life in this book. It's about two characters, Larry Ott and Silas Jones. Larry is white, Silas is black. And Larry's life slowly became my life in ways I didn't expect. I knew a couple of things I wanted to use from my life, events that had happened that I thought were interesting. But I didn't know how much I would wind up using. At some point, when the book was nearly finished, someone read it for me and said, "How autobiographical is this?" And I said, "Not so much." But then I began to think, and I realized the character of Larry, with maybe two or three exceptions, is totally me.
And I wanted to ask you about that, the degree to which landscape plays such a great part in your writing, and the degree to which you're able then to write so specifically about a very specific landscape removed from that landscape, and also how that relates then clearly to what you may be working on now at the Academy.
Well, a couple of things. We do have chestnut trees in the USA, And there are chestnut trees at the Academy that are just remarkable. In fact, there's a sign there that says, "Caution, falling chestnuts." And I love that. And there are studios there that if you sit and work in them, you hear chestnuts falling on the roof. And it sounds like something running across the roof. It's a little creepy. So I am taking details from here and using them in the current project. But being away is hard. It really does make one reach back into memory. So, you know, I think this book, while not autobiographical per se, does have autobiographical aspects simply because I'm dipping back into that memory pool.
Again, talking about landscape in your writing process, but in particular, I think this idea of landscape and memory. You live in Mississippi.
Yes.
Tell us a bit about that, especially being at the university there.
Well, we're in Oxford, which is a very wonderfully blue postage stamp in a very red state. William Faulkner is from Oxford, and so and the university's there, as you said, the University of Mississippi, Ole Miss, they call it. So it has a large number of liberal people. But the thing I love about Oxford, and that my wife loves, is she loves that it's like a block of Manhattan set down in the Deep South. I love the Deep South around it. I can go 5 minutes in any direction and be in woods, be in trees, and that's what I love because I grew up that way. The peacefulness of it, just, you know, the peace there, the solitude that you find. And I grew up as a non-hunter in a hunting family. I knew that if I hunted, people would think I was more normal. So I'd go to the woods, and I would read books. And it became a great place to read. It was just so quiet.
I wanted to ask you something about the idea of being a so-called Southern writer. What does that mean to you?
Being a Southern writer means a couple of different things. First, it means I always have an audience. In the United States, and I think in Germany and in France, they really like Southern writers. There's a kind of exoticism to it for a lot of people. It also comes with baggage. It's easy to write about things that have become cliché, like double-wide trailers and people with double names, Billy Joe, Jim Bob, or whatever like that. And they're easy to ridicule and caricature. That offends me when people do it, and I try myself not to do it, to find the realness, the humanity in these people. When I say these people, I mean poor white Southerners. That's who I came from, and that's who I write about. People who don't have very much, who don't leave the South because they can't. I always say there are two kinds of people in the South, those who choose to be there and those who can't leave. But there's also a lot of anger there. That's not totally why Donald Trump got elected, but all the states, all the southern states, Georgia famously went for Trump. There's a lot of white anger there, I believe. A lot of people who don't see the world going the way they thought that it would.
What does the word genre mean to you in relation to your writing?
The word genre is so interesting that in the last maybe 10 years, it really has begun to change. When I started writing, and went to graduate school even in the early 90s, genre was a dirty word. We had a man who wrote mysteries in our MFA program at the University of Arkansas. And we all, I won't lie, were a little snobby to him. We liked him, but we were condescending about his work. At least I was, in my heart, if not out loud. Something has begun to change, and maybe it's the idea that genre books sell a lot better than literary books. You know, literary books are books that are all about the writing and about deep characterization, where genre books have traditionally been about plot, about what happens. Stephen King has got a great quote about his own fiction versus literary fiction. In his work, he says, he writes about ordinary people in extraordinary circumstances. He says literary fiction is about extraordinary people in ordinary circumstances. So it's the opposite. I love that quote because it's very true. Stephen King is not about language. You don't read him for the language. You read him for the plot. But there are right now a number of writers, I think, who are of my generation. Michael Chabon is one, who writes fantasy novels, but writes them in a literary way. These people grew up reading comic books, as I did, and still love those comic books, as I do. So to them, genre is not necessarily a dirty word anymore. I'm a little schizophrenic when it comes to genre, you know, including the literary genre. And the book I'm working on at the American Academy is a horror novel. I've been struggling with calling it that in a way because it's some kind of baggage. I mean, certain people won't read a horror novel because of some predisposition that they have against it. But I'm just going to write the book that I want to read and then let the rest sort itself out.
University of Mississippi writer and professor Tom Franklin, a Mary Ellen Vonderheiden Fellow in Fiction at the American Academy in Berlin this past fall. You can watch Franklin's reading at the American Academy on our website, americanacademy.de.
My name is Thomas Rommel. I'm the new director of programs here at the American Academy in Berlin. I began here in September of this year.
Thomas Rommel has recently taken on one of the most important jobs at the American Academy. In his position as director of programs, he's responsible for the content and programming of Academy fellows and distinguished visitors. Rommel already knows the Academy quite well. In his former job as provost and rector of Bard College in Berlin, he used to seek out the fellows, visitors, and events at the Academy to enhance the experience of his students.
All I've done is I've changed desks. I haven't really changed my job. I'm just sitting on the other side now, which means that I won't be inviting fellows to come to students, but I'm inviting students and the public at large to come to the Academy and to engage with these academics most of the time, but sometimes authors and artists as well, in a discussion on what it means to be, if you like, a publicly visible figure in the US and to come to Europe and talk to Europeans and to present American life, American culture to a European public. That I find most interesting.
Throughout the Academy's history, American fellows and visitors each semester represented a broad spectrum of academic interests and artistic endeavors. Now, Rommel and the Academy's new leadership team are making a significant change.
Now the idea is there is a thematic focus. We've started the idea of integration and migration, the two big topics that not only shape European life, but that have become, if you like, from a global perspective, extremely important. And we would like to see that all our academic visitors concentrate to a certain degree on one aspect of this big thematic complex of migration and integration. The idea being that if you pursue a problem area from different disciplinary and cultural perspectives, be it as a historian, as a philosopher, as a social scientist, as a literary critic, possibly as an artist yourself, as a writer or, you know, a photographer. And if you look into the entire complex spectrum of anything that is related to the idea of migration and integration, then we, I think, at the Academy are in a position to provide a more complex image of what it means in a modern world to deal with these and to be confronted with these thematic concepts. Through every individual project that's being pursued here at the Academy, to add, if you like, a nuance, a new facet to answering some of the more pressing questions in this concept.
And just as the American Academy's new content focus begins, Americans have voted in a new president, one who may seek to change in some fundamental way the traditional cultural, intellectual, and political relationships between the United States and Germany. We asked Thomas Rommel if perhaps the coming changes in Washington might bring about a shift in the programs and discussions in Berlin.
Now, the American Academy has always prided itself on its nonpartisan, sort of detached, politically neutral position. And this, of course, is something that we will pursue. But it means that in order to reflect what's happening in the United States or in any other country, you need to look at the various echoes that, for instance, the result of an election has. Echoes will be felt in academia, in the arts, in public discourse, and this is something that will be discussed and presented from various points of view at the Academy. What we're interested in is to bring to Germany Americans who see themselves as representative to a certain degree, very visible, vocal, public figures, And of course, their view and take on American culture is something that we at the American Academy would like to share with the German public.
Thomas Rummel, the new director of programs at the American Academy in Berlin, speaking with Berlin Journal.
You're listening to Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin.
This is Silvia Poggioli, senior European correspondent. NPR gives me the chance to report on the changing face of the old continent, from the anguish of the Balkan Wars to the euphoria of communism's collapse and the restitching of democratic Europe. NPR has reporters and bureaus throughout the world because we believe that by striving to understand the world, we better understand ourselves. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Berlin Journal. I'm Ashley Bamford. In the immediate aftermath of World War II, Germany was awash with the men and women who had a direct role in the Nazi regime. The process of denazifying the population and all levels of public life was taken up by the Allies, France, Britain, Russia, and the United States. The process was fraught with competing methodologies and tensions. How exactly former Nazis were prosecuted, or were not, is the subject of historian Rebecca Bolling's work on transitional justice. Bolling has long studied the process of denazification as an academic, and from 2013 to 2015, she directed the International Tracing Service in Bad Arolsen, which archives collections about Nazi persecution, forced labor, the Holocaust, and post-World War II displaced persons. She sat down with Jessica Gino-Hecht of the JFK Institute at the Freie Universität Berlin to discuss her work.
The International Committee of the Red Cross had been administering or managing the ITS, as it's called, in Bad Arolsen in northern Hessen, and primarily as a traditional Red Cross-like tracing service. But starting in 2007, it was opened up for archival and even press research. And up until then, families had written in to get information, which still goes on, 1,000 requests a month from families. But they had never had a historian lead it. It had always been led by people from Geneva, from the International Committee of the Red Cross. In terms of the public view of it, it was pretty closed shop. So they were looking for this international committee that since 55 oversees the ITS, was looking for someone who had better knowledge of the Nazi period, better knowledge of the immediate post-war period, experience with survivor issues. And I had just written a book on a German Jewish family in Essen. And in doing so, of course, had dealt with the family and numerous survivor issues. And I had never come there to do research myself. But when they asked me to apply, which was done by this international committee, they needed someone with administrative experience, and I had started up a research center at my university in humanities, and they needed someone with German and English. They needed someone who also had experience with survivor issues, that knew the history.
And tell us what you learned on these two different levels, both on the kind of institutional level, you working for a German for an institution in Germany in a small town, and on the academic professional level, you working in the setting that you had never worked in before, and what you found there archivally, professionally, intellectually.
Well, what had happened over the years is that more and more only locals worked there, with very, very few exceptions. And given that there's no university close by, most people had never gone to gymnasium either, had not gone to a pre-college high school.
From the immediate surrounding. So you get a good shot of small town Hesse life, right?
And how. And I was die Direktorin, I was the director, because this was a big deal in a town of less than 10,000. And I was a woman, and I was American. I was first in all sorts of ways. And even though the being American was exotic on the one hand, I was able to use it to help transcend the distance between my academic background and credentials, because I could use the expectation of the more populist side of Americans and the more informal side. I also helped my staff learn to laugh at themselves by laughing at me. And these were all traditions that were very unfamiliar in this little town in the context of this very serious
war. And they would accept it because you were American. And of course, the foreigner has privileges that a German director would not have had.
We're listening to an interview with historian Rebecca Bowling of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Bowling served from 2013 to 2015 as the first American director of the International Red Cross International Tracing Service. As a fellow at the Academy last semester, she worked on her comparative study of the denazification process in post-war Germany. Here's more of her conversation with Jessica Gino-Hecht of the Freie Universität's JFK Institute about her study on denazification.
Well, it's interesting because I often start my work on this looking at the theory behind it. And on the one hand, some people had a so-called outlaw theory where they just wanted to pull out the outlaws and that would then purge the society. And then a much broader definition, which I think was actually at play for at least the first 2 years, was one in which you looked at Nazi influence, whether it was street names, whether it was militarism. It was really a concept that encompassed all sorts of things. So it was, how do you undo Nazi influence, and how do you make sure this influence is not playing a role in a new Germany? When I first started my denazification project, and again, this is less focus on the victims like I had at the ITS, but more focus on the perpetrators, or at least the perceived perpetrators. And I was very interested because I was used to the American zone of how the Americans dealt with this. But then increasingly, I decided you really have to do something comparative, and that there's been so little done comparatively. And this was one of my reasons to want to come to Berlin to do this, because in Berlin, I could actually see the interaction of the British, the French, the Americans, and the Russians, even though I'm not doing the Russian side. I just don't have that language skill.
Tell us more about those differences.
Well, the Americans were by far the most schematic and the most ambitious in terms of how many people they wanted to investigate and really look at in terms of party membership, in terms of affiliate membership, institutions like the SS, the SA, but even the Hitler Youth, etc., which, of course, it had a mandatory membership. So it became very clear that they were encompassing way too many people. The British technically were under some of the same constraints as the Americans because they had planned denazification together, and yet they persist in going after the more incriminated longer than the Americans do. The French, people often thought that it was just they were only concerned with French culture, but in fact, that's not true. The French, they were very decentralized, unlike the way the French are in France. And what they did is that early on, already in mid-1945, they had Germans denazifying Germans.
Can you say a word about the Soviets and their denazification efforts?
Well, of course, for the Soviets, you have a situation where the whole interpretation of Nazism was as an exaggerated form of capitalism. So it was a very Marxist interpretation. And it's interesting, though, they were not as schematic as the Americans. So there's actually, although it's very ideological, in some ways, because of course Germans were actually implementing denazification and not Soviets, even though in all cases the Allies had oversight over these processes, they were in some ways also more pragmatic compared to the Americans.
Historian Rebecca Bowling of the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. She spoke with Jessica Gino-Hecht of the Freie Universität Berlin. After the break, we'll hear from Michael Watts on the connections between the rise of Boko Haram and generational politics in Nigeria. You're listening to Berlin Journal from the American Academy in Berlin and NPR Berlin.
Think about the birth of an idea and all the possibilities it presents.
The big idea here.
Whatever brilliant ideas
to believe
you have
in
or
the true
nature, nature of reality
is the
beckons.
Gift of the human imagination.
I'm Guy Raz. Join me each week for an audio journey through the big ideas of our time. Ideas that will change your view of the world on the TED Radio Hour from NPR.
Welcome
Welcome back to Berlin Journal. I'm Ashley Bamford. Nigeria is the most populous nation in Africa. One of every five Africans is Nigerian. The country is rich in oil, and many are quick to cast Nigeria as a resource-cursed nation. Michael Watts, professor of geography and development studies at the University of California, Berkeley, sees Nigeria rife with deeper problems, generational conflict, and weak state authority. This situation, he argues, has given rise to terrorist groups such as Boko Haram. So what's going on in Nigeria? Watts sits down with Bettina Ingels of the Freie Universität to explain.
I should probably provide a bit of background information on Nigeria for the listeners. I mean, Nigeria is obviously a big, complex country, 170 million people. It's a federal system. It has 36 states. It's multi-ethnic. It was primarily, exclusively a British colony up until 1960 and then became independent. It's multi-ethnic. By some estimations, there are almost 400 different types of ethnic groups in Nigeria. So it's a big, multi-ethnic, multi-religious country that right from its independence days was always deeply divided in terms of ethnic and religious forms of identification. Now, this movement, Boko Haram, arose in the north of Nigeria, which is almost exclusively Sunni Islam. And that part of the country has historically been the center of political power in Nigeria. And so that was the area from which, first of all, Boko Haram emerged, and from within the north, actually the northeast of the country, which incidentally is by far the poorest part of the federation. World Bank data suggests that in the northeast, where Boko Haram arose, something like 80 to 85% of the population falls below the absolute poverty line. So in other words, this is an area of endemic poverty.
Yeah, well, actually, could you explain it first what Boko Haram actually is?
Well, Boko Haram refers to a radical Islamist movement that came to international attention really in 2014 in northern Nigeria, northeastern Nigeria, when the Boko Haram militants, this is an armed insurrection against the Nigerian state, when they abducted 300 schoolgirls. This became a national cause célèbre. Really, the movement began as a radical and somewhat heretical Islamist movement in the city of Maiduguri in the northeast of Nigeria, actually back in the 1990s. And Boko Haram, that name, is derived from the Hausa language, the language that's dominant in that part of Nigeria, and it really means something like Western education is forbidden or is a sin. And incidentally, that's not how the followers of the movement refer to themselves. They refer to themselves as followers of the teachings of the Prophet and of jihad. So Boko Haram is really picking up on the fact that when the movement gained national and international attention, it was focused on the degree to which the followers of Boko Haram were rejecting not just Western education, but many aspects of what we might call Western modernity. So that's the context from which this movement arose. But I think the other thing to bear in mind is that long before Boko Haram emerged in the late 1990s, there was a serious debate within the Muslim community of northern Nigeria, Sunni Islams, over Muslim identity and what it means to be a Muslim. And that took the form of a sort of really a ferocious ideological and spiritual battle between powerful Muslim organizations. Nigeria had been dominated in the north by Sufi brotherhoods. Sufi is one particular strain of spiritual Islam. And these organizations had been dominant historically and indeed had led a jihad in the 19th century. But beginning in the 60s and 1970s, other types of more modern Muslim movements began to arise to contest and challenge their authority. So it was in that context of these, if you like, divisions and differences and debates over Islam, Islamic practice, their relationship between Islam and modernity. All of these things had been a subject of debate and protest. And in this period, I'm now talking since the 1970s, there had been a raft of what you and I might call protest, Islamic protest movements, but are within Islam referred to as reformist movements. How and in what ways has Islam, for example, been corrupted, or has it lost certain sorts of practices, or does it need to regain certain forms of legitimacy and authority? So that whole period then, prior to the emergence of Boko Haram, was one in which these debates were very live issues, and in some cases there had been the emergence of what you're calling protest movements, and sometimes quite violent conflicts within the Muslim community. And it was from that Boko Haram emerged.
So we observe religious and Islamic or other religious protest movements all over the world, and also these debates on religion and modernity. So what is the particular Nigerian context of Boko Haram?
It's a great question, because obviously the story at one level is not particularly unusual. But of course, Boko Haram was shaped by the specific circumstances of Nigeria. And in a nutshell, what was distinctive about Nigeria was that it's a major oil-producing state and has been since independence. It's the 9th or 10th largest producer of oil. 98% of its exports, 85% of government revenues, and sometimes close to a third of gross domestic product, all is derived from oil, which is located in the southeast of the country, not in the north. That oil wealth was captured by the Nigerian government in the context of a very competitive, inter-ethnic, inter-religious politics of the 1960s and 70s. What that produced was a ferocious fight over access to that oil wealth. The emergence of a powerful set of political interests that reflected their ability to get access to those oil monies which had been captured by the state. What that produced was not only corruption, it certainly did. The World Bank estimates that $500 billion of oil money has disappeared in Nigeria. Not only corruption, but it produced a fundamental delegitimation of state institutions. If the state is seen to be ineffective, if it's seen to be illegitimate in terms of corruption, if it's seen to not being able to provide schools and healthcare and so on, what we saw then in the oil period was the emergence of the state as being corrupt, amoral, unethical, inefficient, dysfunctional. And that had a fundamental role to play in the rise of Boko Haram, because its primary concern has been Muslim identity, was deeply critical of the Nigerian government for precisely its corruptness. And as they saw it, a corruption which had denigrated the role of Islam in Nigeria. And even though after the return to civilian rule in 1999 in Nigeria, when many of the northern states of Nigeria actually adopted Sharia law, Boko Haram said, actually, they've really not adopted Sharia law. It's not full Sharia law. It's not a pure Islamist country. And they saw that as being wrapped up with the fundamental corruption and immorality of the Nigerian state, seen from that vantage point as being essentially the failure of, if you like, Western modernity and the failure of the Nigerian government to fully implement, as they saw it, Sharia law. But at the same time, as you're saying, that same set of perceptions about state failure was precisely the basis of the emergence of another protest and armed non-state movement on the oil fields of the Niger Delta. That emerged roughly at the same time in 2005, where a movement there began to make similar types of claims, of course, not draped in the language of Islam, because that's a Christian area. It was actually draped in the language of constitutionalism and needing to have a new constitution that would actually reflect the need of local communities to control the oil in the region. In a sense, then, the story of Nigeria, of which Boko Haram is part, is the emergence of two insurgencies. But they both emerged, in a sense, from the same environment of radical state failure.
So where does it go? Can there be any solution?
Well, if the problem is the illegitimacy of particularly state institutions, then a simple answer would be to say the solution is building legitimate institutions. How do we do that in the context of what I've just described, a multi-ethnic, multi-religious, oil-dependent state, which is characterized by these ferocious political struggles over getting access to the oil money? How is that going to happen? Well, I think one of the ways that that's obviously got to happen is for government to become more transparent and accountable. Again, in some parts of the Federation, this is already happening. Civic groups, civil society groups, are precisely demanding, especially at the local level being the local government, which has all sorts of money rushing through it because federal monies from the center of power are allocated to the states and local governments. That's how the oil money is allocated. And yet much of that money disappears, and money that in theory is devoted for developmental purposes never ends up developing anything. So the emergence of civil society groups that are putting pressure on local politicians and local civil servants and local governments, this is certainly beginning that process from the bottom up. So that's one response. But obviously that has to go all the way up. And until, it seems to me, there's a cleaning house at the highest level of corrupt politicians and federal institutions that are not effective. And how that's going to happen is the real question. Until that cleaning house happens, it seems to me we're in for a long process by which these problems are going to be addressed. Let me just say finally that in the case of Boko Haram, there's a real real recognition finally now that so much of the Boko Haram problem is wrapped up with a generation of young men whose prospects, economic, material, political, are so limited that they have become, in some sense then, the militants for Boko Haram. That structural crisis of the economy, the collapse of agriculture, the collapse of the northern textile industries has produced a generation of young men who not only see secular development as being a bad thing and failed, but now some of whom are attracted by the type of militancy of a Boko Haram. And until that radical insecurity, material, economic, political insecurity, until that issue is addressed in some way, then I think the prospects of a long-term solution, that is to say creating a set of conditions in which young men are not attracted by this type of radical Islam, is required in order for there to be a systemic solution to these types of problems.
University of California, Berkeley professor Michael Watts, Siemens Fellow at the American Academy in Berlin this semester. You can view Watts' lecture on our website, americanacademy.de.
We'll be back with more Berlin Journal after this brief break.
You're listening to NPR. NPR is asking tough questions and searching for the answers. NPR is witnessing the moment of triumph, or finding what's at the heart of a disaster. It's journalists across the globe and in your town. NPR is the relationship between you and me. This is NPR.
Welcome back to Berlin Journal. I'm RJ McGill.
Donald supported the invasion of Iraq.
Wrong.
That is absolutely
wrong.
Proved over and over again. He actually advocated for the actions we took in Libya and urged that Gaddafi be taken out after actually doing some business with him one time.
Putin, from everything I see, has no respect for this person.
Well, that's because he'd rather have a puppet as president of
the United States. No puppet.
And it's pretty clear.
You're the puppet.
It's pretty clear you won't admit
that
the Russians have engaged in cyber attacks against the United States of America.
The recent presidential debates were a national spectacle. 70 million viewers tuned in to the third onstage meeting between Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, making it the most watched debate in history. Historian of the medieval era Alex Novikov, in residence at the American Academy last fall, sees a clear lineage from the debate culture of the Middle Ages to the present, not least in the tension between the content of what is said and how it is performed. I sat down with Alex to learn a bit more about the history of debate. Alex, thanks for joining us on Berlin Journal. You're a medieval historian with some interesting interpretations of the medieval public realm, which many people understand to be a sort of bland place. But your project at the Academy, Performing Scholasticism, is about something different. How do you define scholasticism, and what do you mean by performing it?
Scholasticism, as generally understood, means really nothing more than the texts and ideas and the teachers associated with medieval schools and universities. And for the most part, this has been studied from an intellectual history point of view, studying the ideas, the content. I'm really interested in how ideas are performed, how they are embodied, how they escape the confines of the text and inform the public sphere. So when you talk about the public realm, I'm really interested in how ideas leave the ivory tower and actually affect the way people behave outside the schoolroom.
What would be some historical examples of where this would have taken place? Are we talking about meetings of church elders and stuff like that?
So the aspect that I've studied the most up to this point is the history of debate. And debate is more than just something that happens from time to time. It's actually a very basic pedagogical method. And in the medieval schools and universities, debate was something that was practiced and cultivated among the students. And then I think quite naturally, as a result of years of practicing and performing debate, they would take these pedagogical tools, these methods, and apply it to a whole range of other activities. So to give you an example, many of the students who left the universities would then involve debate in their songs, in their theater, in their confrontation with nonconformists, heretics, Jews, Muslims. It becomes a whole method of engaging with the rest of the world, and that's the public sphere that I'm trying to capture in my work.
What makes debate interesting not just as a sort of intellectual sparring, but as a social practice, and where would that social practice be practiced sort of outside? Now we see it on television, we see it on debate clubs and so forth. As a social practice, where is debate located?
I would answer very quickly probably by saying everywhere. You see this not just in the classrooms, but you see this in the public square. You see this in meetings, official or non-official, between different groups, different religions. You start to see this increasingly in the music. I've been very interested in the origins of counterpoint, which often features different voices and different harmonies pitted against one another until a final resolution arrives at the end. You see this in a lot of the art and the artwork increasingly in the 12th and the 13th centuries. Take St. Paul, for example, who is often represented as no more than a saint and a preacher in early medieval art, but by the later Middle Ages becomes, like St. Augustine, the debater par excellence, someone with his finger pointing, someone who is engaging the public, someone who is convincing people by his ability to outperform them in debate. So I don't think we've captured all of the areas that one would find it, but I think you can find it in a lot of areas. And that's why I think it's really important to look beyond just the text and the ideas, but to look at the social sphere, the public sphere, and to see where else we're seeing medieval pedagogical methods replicated.
Were there certain figures that our listeners may recognize that sort of would stand out as almost, you know, rock stars of medieval debate? And who were they, and approximately when were they doing their debate rock star?
Yeah. I would say this starts really in the 12th century. Obviously, debate has existed for a very long time. You find it in antiquity. You find it throughout many different cultures and periods, but it becomes normalized. It becomes institutionalized over the course of the 12th century. Peter Abelard is a very famous example. He's probably most famous for his illicit affair with his student Eloise, but he was also the most famous public debater in the 12th century, and he was a bit of a rock star. And like a lot of rock stars, he was kicked out of his teaching position. Then he had sort of this second, his return to schools, and students flocked to hear him and to watch him and to listen to him and even to challenge him. Increasingly in the later 12th and the early 13th centuries, we hear many stories of teachers who are attracting students because of their charisma, because of their ability to draw a crowd, their ability to think quickly on their feet, their entertainment value even. And I think that too is something that's been up until now pretty much underappreciated as an element of scholasticism. So that's some of the things, and those are some of the things that I'm trying to find.
If I close my eyes right there, I may have thought that you were talking about the debate season that just ended in the United States. Are there parallels between these late medieval debates you study and the debates that we just lived through?
Well, look at it this way. The last presidential debate, I believe, attracted 70 million viewers. That would technically make it the most watched debate in the history of the world. And when you compare that to how little has been written about the history of debate writ large, that's a pretty remarkable phenomenon. Obviously, we're in an era of high mediatization. We have television. We have YouTube. We can watch these things over and over again. But people are tuning in because they want to see the debate and they want to see how it's performed as well as what they're talking about. Obviously, content is always important, and we try to sort of get a sense of their political views. But I would say in many ways, the Trump versus Clinton debate is a very good example of performance trumping content. And I do mean that sort of as a double entendre. But yes, I think it was a wonderful display of the interplay between two phenomenally different characters on stage engaging with one another in visual and theatrical ways, as well as the debates, as well as the topics that they were interested in discussing for the American public.
Very generally, why is debate important to civic culture?
Well, I think it's hugely important. For one thing, this seems to be a feature of the human condition. You can find debate in many different cultures. You can find an Islamic culture. You can find a Jewish culture. You can find a pagan culture. You can find a Tibetan Buddhist culture. And it is certainly a part of our modern culture. We often talk about it as if it's a product of modernity or liberal democracy. I'm not so convinced by that. I think that the freedom to sort of express certain positions and points of view, that may very well be a product of modernity. But I think it's important to recognize that this is an essential feature of the human condition, as I said. And we need to study it like we study any other feature of the human condition. And the fact that there's been so little written about the history of debate, I think points to a whole uncharted territory in which many different scholars can come together, each with their own different perspective.
Alex Novikoff of Fordham University. Novikoff was the Nina Maria Garrison Fellow in History at the American Academy last fall. You can view his lecture on our website, americanacademy.de.
Everybody, including even the Trump-friendly Europeans, of which there are a few, are concerned about, you know, the uncertainty.
Meet Jan Teschau, part of the new leadership team here at the American Academy. As director of the Richard C. Holbrooke Forum for the Study of Diplomacy and Governance, Teschau's concerns include the uncertainties in both Europe and the U.S. about the shape and direction of foreign policy, and specifically the transatlantic relationship in the coming Trump administration. Teschau comes to the job with broad experience in U.S.-European relations, including his most recent stint as director of the European Center for the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace in Brussels. As the transition to a new era takes shape, Jan Teschau spoke with us about the concerns he and others in the field are voicing.
Trump and his foreign policy agenda are an unknown quantity. He has no track record in it, except, you know, the stuff that he said during the campaign. And during the campaign, he has taken many positions and then opposite positions as well. That creates an enormous amount of anxiety. And you learn again why predictability and foreseeability is such a virtue in foreign policy, because once that's gone, you know, the nervousness starts to really be quite big.
Previously on this program, we've covered the Richard C. Holbrooke Forum and its work. Created by the American Academy as a lasting memorial to its founder, the forum brings together experts and practitioners from a range of fields to bear upon some of the world's most intractable diplomatic problems. For example, in our last Berlin Journal, we heard about the sessions convened jointly with the Brookings Institution in Washington devoted to the European immigration crisis. Now, Jan Teschau has taken over leadership of the forum. In January, the Holbrooke Forum kicks off with a panel discussion on post-Atlantic Europe, subtitled Diplomacy and Statecraft Under President Trump.
You know, we basically have three pillars that we want to build into the Holbrooke Forum. One will have to do with the question of migration, refugees, and integration, especially also in the transatlantic context, because when we're talking about transatlantic partners, we're talking about two very, very different cultures when it comes to dealing with migration and refugees. We have on the U.S. side a classic immigration society built on immigration, essentially, with also fundamentally an inclusive instinct. We have, on the other hand, European societies which are not classically immigration societies and whose instinct is exclusive. We will draw the line between who is us and them. And both are under pressure because in both societies now the limits of their, you know, respective models have somehow been reached. Also, there's a big global international aspect to the migration issue, of course, with Africa, you know, increasing its population, with potentially more refugees over the next 10, 15, 20 years coming into Europe's direction. So this issue will stay with us and has this very important additional integration aspect also. How can these new people that, you know, go into our societies actually been made part of these societies? You know, we don't have particularly great tools here in Europe for this. How can we do this better? Pillar number two will have to do with classic issues of global strategy, power balance, the future of conflict, also to a degree the future of war. This is a topic that in Berlin is still something of a taboo often. It's getting better, but I think we need to massage this into the audiences a bit more, that this is actually something that is relevant also for Germany's role as a player in the future. Also has something to do with the question of, you know, how is global governance changing because of a changed global balance of power. And we will do a few big workshops on the strategic triangle between China, Europe, and the US. We hope that this, you know, will give us some spark. And then the third pillar is the question of basically the technological revolution and how that impacts governance, diplomacy, even democracy. You know, how can this hyper-participation, as I call it, where everybody is involved on a daily basis in the opinion-building process and in the decision-making process through social media, through participation that wasn't possible 5, 10, 15 years ago, how is that going to change how institutions, the classic institutions of democracy, stay legitimate? Is there enough of a horizon for us in our small democratic entities, the nation state, to actually, you know, think about the wider context? Also important is the future of truth, the entire idea of post-factual democracy that we've seen both in the Brexit and in the US presidential elections just play out quite interestingly. And so overall, it's quite an ambitious program, and we will not cover all of these things at the same time and initially. But over time, we want to make a contribution to these topics and a few others.
Jan Teschau, the new director of the Richard C. Holbrooke Forum at the American Academy, talking with Berlin Journal. You can learn more about the forum and its activities at holbrookeforum.org and on the American Academy's website, americanacademy.de.
You can also find us on Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube. And that's it for this edition of Berlin Journal, a production of the American Academy in Berlin, NPR Berlin, and NPR Worldwide. Our production team includes Monica Mueller-Kroll in Berlin and Jeff Rosenberg in Washington. We would also like to thank our friends at NPR Berlin for the use of their fantastic new studio space. From the American Academy in Berlin, I'm Ashley Bamford.
And I'm RJ McGill. Thanks for joining us on Berlin Journal.